Hi, and welcome to the Finally Pregnant podcast, the podcast for people who are finally pregnant after infertility and loss. I'm your host, Kat Strawbridge, and after almost 7 years trying with multiple rounds of fertility treatment, which sadly included pregnancy loss, last year I was finally pregnant, and now I'm finally parenting my gorgeous daughter, Ren. I'm delighted to say that this podcast is sponsored by Peanut. Peanut is the app that helps you meet like-minded women who are trying to conceive, pregnant, or already mums. Peanut provides a safe space for women to build friendships, ask questions, and find support. Introducing you to women nearby who are at a similar stage in their journey, Peanut provides access to a community of women who are there to listen, share information, and offer valuable advice. Whether it's understanding IVF, PCOS, miscarriage, or pregnancy and beyond, Peanut is a place to connect with women who understand. I used to go to a weekly rhyme time class with Ren, and between the babies crying, the toddlers singing, and all the general noise and shenanigans, it could be really hard to stop and chat to some of the other mums. So when one of them connected with me on Peanut, it was fab. We made a beeline for each other at the next class and even went for a coffee together afterwards. Because of the app, it meant there was a friendly face in the room, which I have to say was just really lovely. You can download the app for free today. Head to peanut.app.link/finallypregnant or search for Peanut in your app store. And when you do, make sure you head over to the Finally Pregnant group. Hello, hello. How are you doing? I hope that you're all right. Lockdown continues. And as I look out my window, it is a very grey January day. But you know what? We've had the winter solstice. Things are good, moving in the right direction. Oh my gosh, I'm clearly feeling a little bit desperate. Obviously, the winter solstice was last year. Anyway, we are heading towards spring. That is the way that I am choosing to look at things. And I hope that that has put a smile on your face, fingers crossed, because it's just, yeah, I'm not going to talk about it. It's tough. We all know it. I'm not going to talk about it anymore. Do you know why? Because we've got much more exciting things to talk about. And it's not going to be the voting. I promise you I won't talk about that because that's closed. So now we just wait and I bite all my fingernails off wondering whether or not the Finally Pregnant podcast has been voted best podcast. Fingers crossed. But what else is going on? The other exciting stuff that I mentioned. Firstly, Ren's walking is improving every day, which is very exciting. She seems to be really nicely settled into her new class. And she's just, oh, she's just the best. She's saying more and more words. Our favourite one at the moment is cheek, which is cheek. And it's just really, it's really like the noise is just a really lovely noise. But yeah, so she's fun. Although her favourite word is pepper, pepper. Peppa. And honestly, that pig, oh my goodness. But you know, she loves it. What are you gonna do? In other news, this morning I've been recording actually all morning today. The first thing I did today was the Every Story Matters panel for the Kat and Alice Live Your Life virtual, which is happening on Saturday the 30th of January, and you can still get your tickets. In fact, I'll tell you something about tickets in a second that I don't think I mentioned last week. Oh, well, you can hear it again. It'll be fine. And some people will be new. Hi. So you won't have heard it before at all. And hi to the old faithfuls too, obviously. So anyway, I recorded the panel this morning with James, Seetal and Ruth. And it was so, I don't want to say fun. It doesn't feel like the right word, but it was just really invigorating. And just, I love hearing people's stories. I know that might be obvious because I run a podcast, but I really love it. And it was incredible chatting to these three extraordinary humans who have all had such difficult but such different fertility experiences. And that leads me on to a conversation that I then had, which is next week's podcast. And that's with Natalie, who has got a son, Phoenix, through treatment and made the decision last year with her husband to donate her three or their three additional embryos. And so that is very poignant for me right now because we have one embryo and we are kind of deciding what we're going to do with it. But Linking the two, when we were in the Every Story Matters conversation, one of the guests mentioned about how all she wants is one happy, healthy baby. And it did really make me sit back and think, because I remember so vividly being in that position. And now I am in that position. And yeah, it just for that moment, I'm not going to talk about it any more than that, because we talk about it in the episode with Natalie. But it really made me stop and think. And I guess just be so incredibly grateful. And I don't want to upset anyone who is still trying right now, but to be so incredibly grateful that we have got Ren and that we're not in the position where we are trying for our first. And like, all it makes me want to do is reach out and hug you even more. If you're listening to this because of, you know, you want to hear other people's stories of hope. And some of you might be listening to this because today's episode is about adoption, because that is one of the options in front of you. I really, really want to reach out and give you a huge hug. And I wish, and I was reading something about this just earlier about a crystal ball. It was on the Preggers Kitchen. And she was saying about the crystal ball, I wish I had a crystal ball that I could give you so much. I really, really do. But anyway, I'm going to carry on, because like I say, some of that conversation is next week. Some of it will be today and about adoption. And before I move on very quickly, I mentioned tickets for the Live Your Life virtual event. So they are now £40. However, we have launched a no questions asked £15 ticket, because we know A, that treatment can totally drain that bank account, and B, in a pandemic, there are huge financial difficulties for people with regards to losing jobs and not being able to work and so on and so forth. So there, that ticket is there. We do not want money to be a barrier. If you cannot afford the £15, get in touch with us, okay? This is an event we want you to be at. This is an event that you need to be at. It's just going to be incredible. I've loved even like the technical check-ins and seeing loads of people on the screen. And I know some people might be all zoomed out, but this is going to be different. It really, really is. Well, it's not on Zoom, but you know, obviously other things aren't completely different, but yeah, it is going to be amazing. And if you are dealing with secondary infertility like me, then you are welcome as well. Obviously, it goes without saying, please be sensitive. But we have had events in real life events where we have had people with little miracles in their tummies come along, and everyone is welcome. It's just about sensitivity, which I know that if you're listening to this, you will completely understand. But moving on, if you have got a little one in your tummy, make sure you book the yoga sessions for February now, because places are going. At the time of recording this, there were only two spots on the Wednesday class, which may be there still, might not be. There are a few more on the Monday, but get booking. The last thing before I talk about today's guest in any more detail is to ask you to subscribe, rate and review the podcast. Please do. I'm at about 82 or so. So, you know, help me get up to that little century, if you would do, with the whole reviews. If you can't do it on Apple, I totally understand that. I do. That's fine. So last but definitely not least, I am talking today to the wonderful Sarah, who is someone that I used to run with actually many years ago. We do talk about this in the episode, so I'm not going to talk loads about it. We've stayed in touch over the years and the power of Facebook. And I know that she has adopted a lovely son, and she's recently written a book about adoption. And so I wanted to get her on so that she could share her story with you and tell you a little bit more about the book that she's written. So that's it for now. I look forward to seeing you for this series finale next week, or hearing you, or you listening, you know what I mean. And yeah, stay in touch. Take care. Bye bye. Hi there, Sarah. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Oh, I'm really, really well, thank you. So I have mentioned already who you are and what you're doing here. but I just wanted for you really to introduce yourself. Back in the days of us living quite locally to each other, we used to go to a fabulous running class, actually, didn't we? And the reason I started, because Bob started it with me, the reason we started running, funnily enough, at that point was because we were seriously, you know, kind of getting into the whole trying to conceive thing right at the very beginning of our journey. And I remember hearing you talking, and I guess like things didn't really add up for me until many years later. But I remember hearing you talking about, I think around that time you were having a hysterectomy and other things were going on. And like when you then find yourself deep in a trying to conceive journey, you look back at things and realize actually what you, like I realized what you were going through, which was immense right then. I kind of want to go back and give you a hug. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, bless you.
But it's just really good to be able to now catch up many years later, and you are in a very happy space with your wonderful husband and your wonderful son. And you've just written a book, which we will talk about, but you've kindly offered to come on here and share your story about kind of your fertility journey and the adoption kind of process. So yeah, tell us, start from the beginning.
Absolutely. It actually took us 8 years to have a child, so a very long time. We started, obviously, as you think, everything's going to be fine, got married, thought it was all going to work out, and it very clearly didn't, straight on, really. And we went through like the whole thing of going to get tested, you know, going to the doctors, and then we went, that wasn't happening, and it felt like years. So it was like about 1 or 2 years, I think. And then we did some IVF treatment, which I believe you went through the same kind of process, didn't you, with IVF? Yeah. So we did IVF for, I think, 2 times in the end. And sadly, the first one, I had an ectopic pregnancy out of it, which was very, very traumatic, very, very difficult. And it happened quite quickly. So within like 2 weeks of finding out that we were pregnant, being very happy, very elated. And it's a bit weird, isn't it? Because it's not like the normal thing of when you get pregnant and you have that kind of 3 month window where you're not really telling anybody, because everyone knows that you're going through what you're going through. It's not secret, it's not private. So yeah, we kind of, all our close friends, all our you know, our family all knew what we were going through. And we had that call to say that we were pregnant and very excited. And then within 2 weeks, I was just not feeling very right. And I kept, you know, Googling it, as you do, which is not good, not healthy by any stretch. And I kept saying, you know, I think I'm having symptoms of an ectopic. And, you know, my husband was like, no, my best friend was like, no, you're just over dramatizing it, Sarah, just, you know, chill out a little bit. And then I went to the hospital to get some medication, and then all of a sudden I had this big massive twinge, and then that was the kind of a topic kind of rupturing. And then I actually had to go all the way back home again. So they didn't see me. I had to go back home. But I just thought I was being overly dramatic still, that it was just something that had happened. So in the end, yeah, the ectopic was awful. It was kind of, I would say, one of the worst experiences I've had to go through as a person, because I thought I was fearing for my life at that point. You know, it was very, very scary. I didn't know what was happening. I was rushed into surgery. Everyone looked very worried around me. And I was like, I don't know what's happening. Yeah, so we got through that. And then we decided to have another go.
Why not? You know, you just do, don't you? We put ourselves
as you do
so much.
Yeah. And we had 2 frozen embryos left. So you kind of don't want to waste them. They're costing money. They're quite expensive to freeze. So they're costing money. So you don't really want to waste them. But I was told at that stage that I had adenomyosis. So it's very similar to endometriosis. So endometriosis is more about kind of tissue, isn't it, that kind of sits within areas. So I think it's supposed to disperse naturally, and it doesn't, and then it creates these pockets and this scar tissue within you. And lots of women suffer from endometriosis, but adenomyosis is actually inside the womb. So it's a similar thing, but it's the womb lining. And I found out after I went through IVF that it was like a really massive problem. So my womb was kind of 10 times the size that it should have been. I was very swollen, very sore. So I had to go through a lot of treatment to actually deal with that. So that was a lot of hormonal treatment. I had to have injections to kind of reduce it down. So I was going through IVF and being prodded and poked with all different kind of hormones. And then I had to have these hormones to suppress and kind of, I guess, go through the menopause, if you like. So they switched me off. And that wasn't much fun. And then we decided after that we would try one more time because we did have the embryos left. But it was weird because the first time I felt pregnant straight away, I did feel the difference in my body changing. And it's weird because you think to yourself, well, surely you wouldn't know within that few window, but I definitely could feel something happen. Whereas the second time round, it was definitely not happening. I could feel that it hadn't really worked. And it's very disheartening. It's very kind of like, this is our last go here, really. It kind of slams you back down into reality of how difficult it is to have a child.
Yeah, because you go in, don't you, thinking, oh, excellent, a couple of rolls in the hay, we'll be good. And then slowly but surely you do, you know, for want of a better phrase, often get beaten down, don't you, by bad news after bad news and heartbreak and trauma, essentially. And so you said at the beginning there that you had the two rounds. So that second round didn't work.
No.
And did you know, where were you from there? How were you feeling? What were your options, like to go again, to be childless? You know, where were you?
I think at that point, I think I'd had enough personally. I think because, you know, I was getting to my 40s by that point, and you're kind of thinking your biological clock's ticking. You know, they were telling me I wasn't producing as many eggs as I would have been if I'd have been 20, 30. And then you think to yourself, well, why didn't I do something about this earlier? But, you know, it's just what life is, really, isn't it? You kind of go with the flow. You just expect it to be, it just happened normally. And yeah, it just felt very much, I think I'd had enough of being prodded and poked. And I'd been, you know, having a period, I didn't have great periods. And then having IVF, it sort of takes it to a different level of how I felt really out of control. I didn't like how it was making me feel. It was a bit like I felt a bit psychopathic at times. It just kind of made you go a bit wild, a bit crazy. And it's not nice because it makes you anxious. It makes you depressed. You know, it makes you kind of question everything. And I just didn't like how I was feeling. And I just wanted it to stop, really. So, and at that point, the consultant was kind of saying to us in a very nice roundabout way, you don't really have much chance of conceiving, either naturally or through IVF. You know, I think it was about a 10% chance when we started, and then it had gone down to about, you know, 6 or 7% by that point. And it's really kind of, the percentage is going against you. You think to yourself, really, do I want to go through this? So, and at that point as well, he obviously was very concerned about the adenomyosis that was inside me. It was causing me huge amounts of problems. I was having massively bad periods and having to go to A&E for just severe bleeding and stuff like that. It was just very not pleasant as a woman, you know, having to kind of not be able to do anything for like a 2-week period. I was just so paranoid about going out, about embarrassing myself, about having to keep going to the toilet or having to be conscious about what I'm wearing. All these things kept going in my head. And I was obviously in a lot of pain as well. So it was making me very grumpy. I wasn't the best person to be around, put it that way. My husband said he was either going to move out or he was going to get me to move out.
And it's amazing, isn't it? Like, to a degree, the front we put on, because I think of you as this like enthusiastic, bouncy, just like joyous individual. Like, that is who you were when you rocked up to a running club. Like, that is who you were. And clearly there was so much going on behind the scenes, wasn't there?
Yeah, definitely. And it was weird, actually, because the choice was then to have a hysterectomy. And obviously that was a time when I knew you. So it was kind of like, I didn't feel like I had much choice. It wasn't a case of I want to hold on to it. It wasn't doing anything for me. Having a womb wasn't doing anything for me. It was actually making my life a lot harder. So I did think about it and I did kind of, you know, toy it over for a while. But ultimately, yeah, it had to go, basically. Sadly enough, I knew what it meant And I think at the time it was kind of just because we actually had started the adoption process at that point. When we'd gone through IVF, we actually had started to think about adoption. We had talked it over with the consultant. He actually had adopted a child himself. He had his own birth child and an adoptive child. So it was actually really lovely to hear his view and to see what he thought. And yes, and we had gone through the process at that point. We were kind of getting to the stage where we were going to start the journey, and then it had to be stopped and halted while I had to go through a hysterectomy. So again, that was very traumatic because I was very scared of hospitals at this point. Didn't like them. You know, when I had an ectopic, I was in hospital for a week with a really bad infection. And, you know, it was a place that I, you know, people don't like hospitals, generally speaking, but I kind of had always thought they were quite nice places to begin with when I was younger. And actually, I get quite anxious and very sort of worried about them and quite panicked about them now, just because of the scenarios I've been in. And I didn't want to go back there. And I remember sitting talking to the consultant before I walked into theatre, and I was scared. I was absolutely petrified that something was going to happen again. And sadly, it did.
Oh, no.
So I had a hysterectomy. It all went fine. And I was in hospital for about a day and then came home. And then I got another infection and I ended up back in hospital. So I left. I was at home for about a week and I was again feeling weird. And, you know, everyone was telling me, you know, again, you're being paranoid. And you know, like how you go with your instinct. It's your gut, isn't it? It's how you feel. Nobody else understands how you're feeling. I know there's something not going on right inside. Yeah. And I went back and I had an infection at the site where they had removed my womb. So I guess there was something that was still there and it got infected. So I went back into hospital and I was in there for another week.
You definitely don't want to be going back to hospital anytime soon after that, do you? For sure.
No, no. And I was, you know, very, very stressed, very, very anxious, very, you know, just, I was like, are you even joking me that I'm here again in this same scenario? And yeah, it took me a while because I was grieving in the sense of not being able to be a natural mother. I think, you know, that's a big deal. And I think what happens, though, sadly, is that when you go through these things, you don't always allow yourself the time that you need to grieve, because even I've been writing my story actually recently, just kind of jotting it down. And it's amazing how, like, ectopic pregnancy, I never really talked about losing a baby. You know, the baby was very, very small. But to me, you know, they were still a baby there and it could have developed into something. But, you know, I was more concerned, my husband was more concerned about me living at that stage. And that kind of didn't really ever get talked about again. And then the same, I guess, with the hysterectomy, it was more about me and me surviving that scenario and not having any issues. And yeah, sometimes it takes a little, because it always can sort of hit you, can't it? It kind of can smack you when you don't realize it. It kind of, you know, one day you could be, and I think I did, I remember going to someone's like christening or something, and I literally just broke down and I had to leave. Because it just hit me in that moment how I kind of would not ever have that situation of being a natural mother, I guess. And it was really strange because I didn't expect it. And I think sometimes those scenarios are that you don't expect them. So therefore they hit you more.
Yeah, I think that has probably, like, hands up, I've definitely been in that situation. Not obviously following a hysterectomy where it is completely final, basically. Yeah. But yeah, wondering and kind of convincing myself that that wasn't going to happen because, you know, evidence to that point had led us to that conclusion. Did you seek any support? Like, are you offered any support when you are going to have a hysterectomy, for example? Because you were quite young. Like, how old were you when that happened?
Yeah, I think I was about 37, 38 at that point. So yes, very young to have one. They kind of don't really like giving women hysterectomies at that age, unless it's obviously medically necessary. I think they did offer me counselling, but it kind of feels, I guess, maybe a bit disjointed. You don't ever feel really connected. You know, like how when you seek help, you want to really feel that that person is going to help you. And I just didn't feel, it felt more like it was like an off the cuff thing. Like it wasn't like a real session, or it wouldn't really help me. So I think I never went, or it wasn't certainly pushed on you too much. So I don't think I ever went and really talked about it in any detail. Certainly not that at that point anyway. I think probably later I would have spoken about it more, definitely.
I think when we're in the midst of stuff, you almost, not that you don't want to talk about it, but you, well, from my personal experience, I think that I, you know, I'm dealing with the practicalities of it ultimately. And you kind of go through the step by step and the going to the hospital and getting this done and that kind of thing. And I don't think, well, I think I'm guilty of this, of, you know, like not thinking about my emotional state, knowing that I'm in an emotional state, absolutely, but not necessarily supporting myself as well through that. And I think sometimes perhaps one can't, because they are dealing with the practicalities, and it isn't until a bit later that you go back and actually revisit that and seek that support. But I think the reason I say this is because I want people to know that it is important, even if you don't do it at the time, and that is, you know, not always possible, as I mentioned, that you do go later so that you can kind of deal with it retrospectively.
Yeah, definitely. Because I've had counselling since then, you know, and I've sought it myself. And again, finding the right counsellor, finding who you think is going to help you, because not, you won't always gel with someone straight away. But yeah, like you say, you're in survival mode, aren't you, really? So you're kind of going through the motions. You're going through, yes, you're going to have times where you're sitting there sobbing with your husband and you're going through that. But that's kind of like a bit of a release. You may not necessarily still be talking about it in the depth that you need to. But yeah, you just kind of keep going, don't you, really?
Yeah, I think survival mode is the exact right. Yeah, that's the way to put it, for sure.
Yes,
for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So you have survived everything you've been through thus far. You are fully healed now after your hysterectomy. You had put the adoption process on hold to go through that. How quickly do you get back to that? Did you go and see a counsellor straight away, or talk us through the next few months or years?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we'd started the adoption process quite early on in that year, and I had a hysterectomy in like the November. So we'd already gone through a little bit of the workshops. We'd been approved to be adopters at that point. And it was, you know, we were having social workers coming around our house and they were kind of talking to us. They would interview us together. They would interview us separately. They're asking lots of very, very personal, detailed questions. You're having to fill out forms with tons and tons of information. Yeah. And then obviously it stopped for, I think I allowed it to stop for maybe 2 months or so. So like from November, it was early November, I needed time to recover. I was still working as well during this point. So I kind of had time off work. So I had a hysterectomy, had time off work, and then ended up having quite a bit more time off work because of the fact that I had such a bad time with it. So I think I was off work for like 6 or 8 weeks or something like that after recovery. And then we picked up the adoption journey again, probably in the February, I would say. And then by that time, I was having a bit of counselling. I was just trying to get used to the idea and just kind of trying to air how I was feeling. And interestingly, talking to a social worker, it was actually quite nice. People do think, you know, social workers come in and they want to kind of, you know, look at your life and they're judging you and, you know, they're trying to find something that's, you know, not so great, or, you know, it's like an interrogation. But actually, you know, they're doing a very, very important job because they are trying to make sure that you are matched to the right child and that you fully appreciate and understand what it is like to have a child. Because if you're not kind of surrounded by children day to day, which we weren't really, we didn't have many friends that had children. You know, Steve's sister has children, but she lives quite far away. So we didn't get to see them often. So we didn't have much contact with children at that point. So yes, it's very important, but it was lovely in the sense that we got to chat to her. She came round every week. It was funny because you do make sure that your house is immaculate.
Tidying,
dusting, buying, you know, new rugs and stuff to put out and make everything look nice, trying to, you know, they say, oh, you bake some cakes to make it smell nice and all that stuff. But you quickly get over that. And, you know, at the end of the day, they're just there to talk to you, really, aren't they? So they do walk round and they do have a look at your house. And they're kind of, you think, oh, are they inspecting it for... But they're looking to see if it's child friendly. Ultimately, you do need to have a child friendly house. You do have to adapt and you have to make changes. And again, if you're not in that mindset of necessarily knowing what a child might need at that point, then you may miss things which social services would be able to tell you to kind of sort out, like the plug sockets and all those kind of things that you might miss. So, yeah, so we went through the process and we were actually approved fairly quickly. I think it generally takes, they say now, because they've sped it up a bit, about 6 months, maybe slightly longer, 8 months to get through that whole process. You know, you have to have references. You have to, you know, they have to kind of interview your family and friends and all those kinds of things. And they ask lots of different questions. So, yeah, so we got through that stage and then we thought, right, OK, let's what's going to happen now? And again, it's quite bizarre because it opens your eyes to a whole different realm of reality, to the amount of children that are out there that need some help. They need some love and they need support. And it's very, very heartbreaking to kind of. And it's very strange and it's no, they can't do it any other way. There's like a website you go on and you basically, it's like shopping for a child in the sense of that you go onto this website, you see their faces, you see the profiles of these children. They explain things about the children, the history of the children to a point, you know, it's not kind of telling you too much detail. And it is like picking yes or no, do I want to progress with the child? And we went through that for a while. We went to various kind of adoption open days, which they have where you go. It's like a recruitment day, if you like. You go around and there's lots of stalls, you know, tables where lots of adoption agencies are obviously looking to promote the children within their agencies and trying to find them new parents. But again, we came away with like 25 profiles and you're like, what do I do with these? You know, at the end of the day, these are little people's lives and I could be making a difference to them. How do I choose a child? How do I kind of like reject a child? You know, I felt bad not wanting to look at the profile and it was kind of that emotional thing that was really difficult. But we thought it would be easy in the sense that we thought we were very much, you know, an ideal couple on paper that would really be good to adopt a child. And it just wasn't happening. We kept getting no's all the time. We were told that we were nearly close to being matched and then something would happen. And we were getting very, very frustrated. And then you'd ask for feedback and you wouldn't really get much feedback. And then it was just getting more and more frustrating. And I think we probably waited about a year, maybe a bit longer. And we sort of changed our tactics. So we thought, okay, well, what do we do? So we're saying no to children. So we'll say yes to all the children they send us now and see if that makes any difference. And, you know, we didn't have preference necessarily. You know, they ask you preference, boy or girl, you know, not no concern at all. They ask you for your age range. And again, we'd been told it's quite hard to have a baby. So we would go from a, you know, 0 to 5, 0 to 6 sort of scenario, but not older child. They ask you if you would be able to deal with a child that has more learning disabilities and things like that. And you have to be very honest and you have to be very open about what you think that you can deal with as an adult, as a parent. Because obviously some children just need that additional support. And you may not necessarily feel comfortable with that. So, yeah, we carried on for ages. And in the end, we actually complained. So we complained, didn't really get anywhere from social services perspective. I think this was even going into like 2 years by this point. And we were like, I don't really understand what's going on. Why is it taking so long? And we weren't really getting a lot of feedback. I think I got feedback once, which we were horrified with, that my hair was the wrong colour.
Oh my, really? I'm like, it, but actually, no, natural. Hang on. Let's kind of, yes, well, and for people who don't know, because it used to be quite a red, didn't it?
Yes, it was sort of more already a brownier colour, but now I guess, it's black.
Well, but to put that into perspective, like, that isn't a, oh my God, your hair's the wrong colour, so I don't like you aesthetically. Is it because of ethnicity, or was it just a...
I think it was, I mean, generally speaking, they do like to match culturally together, because they gave us, if you like, a scenario where this guy, this mixed race guy, was brought up by a white family. And then he said that he did feel very much kind of, you know, not felt right, in the sense that they weren't able to give him his cultural background. And he definitely felt very out of place in that scenario. I think he was brought up in Ireland. And I think they say it's very important to make sure that they can have, you know, their background, their history can be something. But yeah, hair colour shouldn't really be an issue. At the end of the day, you know, a child can come out looking very differently to their parents.
Well, and you're not necessarily trying to match someone to look the same. And like you say, like, yours was a very, like, dyed red, wasn't it? So yes, it wasn't exactly your natural colour anyway. So.
No. And it was quite ridiculous. And I think that actually made us quite angry at that point. We were like, are you even joking? You know, you're looking at us on paper to be this kind of model couple that work, you know, we've worked since very young, you know, we have no issues. Yes, I've had some medical problems, but ultimately that shouldn't be a factor. But interestingly, yeah, so we went to our MP in the end, and he was very fundamental in it changing for us. So our local MP, I contacted him on Facebook. He asked to meet with us. Then he wrote to social services, and basically MPs of have a lot of power, a lot of strength behind them, and social services had to write back to him with kind of the reasoning behind it. And then our social worker kind of got a little bit, she came round and she was a little bit, because I think we'd been given a trainee, so she was a great person, but we'd been given a trainee, and therefore they decided they were going to give us the best social worker. So they, our social worker then changed to this other lady who basically just changed our lives. She was absolutely amazing. She's still in our life now. You know, she's helped me with my book. I talk to her, you know, most days, and she's just amazing, you know, and she literally turned it round for us. And she was the first person that was very honest. And she said to us, the reason why you're not being approved is because you have epilepsy, Sarah. And it was the first time that it was like, are you serious? Why has no one mentioned this to us before? Because obviously we could have adapted our profile to kind of, you know, put more focus on that, or put more focus on what we would do in scenarios to kind of help us along. But she was the first person to flag it. And ultimately, you know, again, I could have my own child and I've still got epilepsy.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna, you know, I can't do anything about it, sadly. Yes, I can take medication. Yes, I can be careful. But ultimately, I don't have much warning. And if I have an epileptic fit, then it just happens. You know, it happens. Me and you could have this conversation and it could happen. But it was very much that they were kind of holding that against us, I think. And that was the reasoning. And I guess if they have another couple, it's a similar, like a job interview, isn't it? If they have another couple that presents in a different way, then they're going to go with that couple. So anyway, she fought our corner, and within, I would say, within probably 3 months, even maybe less than that, she told us that there was a baby.
Oh.
Even saying it now, it makes me
emotional. I know, I feel I've gone all tingly, absolutely.
And you know, but it felt like she was fighting our corner. It felt like she was really pushing to get us the child that we wanted, you know, that we were waiting for. And interestingly, she actually told us about 2 babies on the same day, which really freaked me out. And I was like, okay, I don't need choice now. Don't give me choice.
Oh my gosh, my gosh.
But both scenarios were very similar, that the birth mother was pregnant and they'd only just found it out, and they were going to be born within a certain time frame. And basically, would we be interested? And of course, you know, you're going to go, yes, okay, yes, please. But you don't know nothing about them. You know, you don't know what sex they're going to be. You literally, you only know the detail about the parents at that point. So they give you history about the parents and things like that. And then, you know, it's whether you think that that's something that you can deal with. At the end of the day, there's a reason why the child is being taken away, without going into too much detail. But, you know, at the end of the day, children are adopted because they're not being looked after by their parent. They're not being given the love, the nurture and support. And there was history prior to our son. So that was kind of a thing that was always going to happen.
Something just kind of, and this is generally speaking from what I've read and seen, that sometimes it can be things like substance abuse or,
yes,
you know, that, yeah. And so that's why they know, even though the baby hasn't been born yet. And I know, for example, Nick Finney's book, The Bumps Ahead, which is an amazing book. Yeah, absolutely amazing book. And he talks about how it can happen, you know, with siblings. And so siblings become, because people don't use protection, they get pregnant again. Yeah, and yeah. Then they end up having another child, which then essentially is going to be taken away and adopted. Yeah. And sometimes they can be the reasons that a baby is up for adoption.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, because they would have had a history before, social services know them, you know, it's kind of, sadly, I think there's people that continue to go through the process of having lots of children, and they continue to have children taken away from them, and they just can't break that cycle, sadly. And, you know, it's very, very heartbreaking, but it does obviously allow the likes of me to be able to have a beautiful son. So, yeah, so we waited. We were actually on holiday when we found out that he'd been born, which was very freaky. And we were kind of like sitting there kind of, you know, oh, wow, this is, you know, but at that point, you don't know if you're being matched. So you, at that point, it's still very much you don't necessarily know what's going to happen, because, you know, they may decide that he should stay with his birth parents. They may decide that he needs to go with a different couple, you know, so there was still a lot going on with that. And then we were going through the process, and you have to have an adoption order. So the judge has to have an adoption order. And he was actually put into foster care straight from birth. So he was very much kind of born, and then straight away he was put into foster care, like literally the day after being in hospital. But obviously his parents at that point are allowed to have contact with him. So there's a contact center, and he would have seen them as a very young child. But, you know, obviously he doesn't remember that. But there are photos we have of that, which is important for him to have access to. And then we found out, and it's interesting because you're working, and again, you have to be open to what is happening in this scenario, because again, it's not like having a baby. You don't have a big bump and people aren't expecting you to go. You know, I literally was told, you know, I was given about 2 weeks' notice to leave my job.
Wow. And did your job know that you were going through an adoption process?
Yes. You kind of have to tell them, because of the fact that you have to be very open to, you know, you have to leave. You have to go on maternity leave literally within 2 weeks of finding out. You don't get 9 months to kind of plan it. So, yeah, it was a very quick thing. And again, you go into this mode of just, it doesn't really digest, if you like, because you go into that planning mode, don't you? That, I mean, goodness, we're going to meet our son for the first time, but we also need to plan our house. We had to decorate our house. We had to buy a cot. We had to buy nappies. We had to, you know, buy clothes, all these things that you generally might have a bit more time to do. We did it within 8 days. I think we met him within 8 days. They kind of do like a plan of introductions. So, you know, you go and see him for the first time. And again, that's such a surreal experience to walk in to a room where there's a baby, thinking, I'm going to be taking him home in a week's time. And again, you just don't really comprehend how that feels. He was just joyous. You know, he reacted to us very, very well, very quickly. He came to us, you know, she said, the foster carer said that, you know, normally he's a little bit kind of not sure. Babies tend to go with who they know, don't they? They don't like strangers as much, but he came to us very easily. We were supposed to be there, I think, for about half an hour was the first introductions, and I think we were there for about 2 hours. And they plan it, you know, so you have to spend time with him, you have to feed him, you have to bath him, you have to do the morning routine with him, so get up really early when he woke up. So we had to be there at, like, you know, 5-6 o'clock in the morning one morning. We had to put him to bed at nighttime and do his nighttime routine. And it was just all those things. But it was weird because you would go there, you would do that for an hour or 2 hours, and then you would come back again to your, you know, your normal life of just being you two. But we were just frantic, you know, because we were just trying to get the house ready.
Oh, God. And everything else in order, like, as much as you have prepared, and, you know, social worker is amazing at this point, which is great to hear. It must just be, you know, because when you're, like, in my experience of having Ren, you kind of, you know what's going to happen, but you just don't really know. And that must be, that you must have been feeling exactly that. Like, you know, I've heard and I've bought all the stuff, and but what's it actually going to be like? So what was it like when you brought him home, and how has it been ever since?
Yeah, it was strange. It was just very surreal. It just felt very surreal for quite a long time afterwards, because you don't have, I guess, from a woman's perspective, you don't have the same kind of, you haven't given birth, you don't have the same, you know, the hormones that you're, that bonding hormone that's supposed to, you know, gel you together, which doesn't happen for every person. But, you know, the bonding is massively important, and that doesn't happen straight away, you know. At the end of the day, we brought him home, and I remember kind of carrying him in his little carrier and sitting him in, and you kind of look and you think, what do I do now? It's the same as when you bring a baby home from hospital. You're like, what do I do now? I've never done this before. And you kind of just learn as you go. We took him to the local cafe, but they're very much at that point that you have to, it's interesting because you're not allowed to see anybody else for 2 weeks. So again, it's very much, you don't have that whole, you know, celebration. You don't have that whole, let's come round and meet him, and everyone's round, the grandparents around, and your family and your close friends. It was none of that, because they don't want an overload. So this poor little boy needs to bond with his new mummy and daddy. He doesn't need an overload of all these other strange faces looking at him when he's just been, you know, ultimately he would have just thought he'd been removed from his mum. His foster carer would have been his mummy to him. So ultimately that is quite traumatic for a little one. And you don't necessarily realize that at the time. I mean, he was an absolutely wonderful baby, in the sense that he was happy all day, he slept, he was great. At nighttime, it was a different scenario.
Oh, they just know, don't they? They know.
It was just constantly, we couldn't settle him. He did look quite distressed. So at times it looked like he was kind of looking around for his foster carer, you know, kind of just searching for the person that he was used to comforting him. And it was really hard, you know, as a parent, you know what it's like. You don't have sleep. It turns you a bit crazy.
Yeah, totally. And did you, and I think that this is new parents alike, like, is there just a massive imposter syndrome? Like, am I really this person's? Am I? Is this baby in my house? You know, all of that kind of stuff. Is that?
Well, we kept creeping because we had like a loft room, so we slept in the loft room as normal. But obviously, you don't want him to be downstairs, so we put the cot in our room, and we literally were like creeping around in the house for ages because we were trying not to wake him up, or we were awake like the whole night because we were like trying to be as quiet as possible. But you realize that you do have to kind of give yourself a bit of slack. You have to give yourself, you have to take turns, you know, you need to rest as a new parent, because otherwise it just makes you crazy. It just literally, sleep deprivation is one of the worst things ever. And you just can't think straight, you know, you're not as relaxed and calm as you would be normally. And I think it did take us a little while to really get used to him being there. I think as well, it was very much that shock factor of going from literally 2 weeks ago having a fairly normal life and going out and being spontaneous and going out with your friends, and then your whole life does change dramatically. And I think we were probably a little bit naive to think it wouldn't. But I think sometimes you think your support network is different to what it actually is. You know, some friends sadly don't support you the way that you think they're going to support you. I didn't have lots of friends that had children either. So I felt a little bit kind of isolated, I think, certainly for the first little while. It was very new to me going to baby groups. As you said, feeling a bit like an imposter, kind of going to these groups and they're talking about breastfeeding and giving birth, and you're trying to kind of get with the vibe. I remember we were looking for a house once, and this estate agent we had a little boy at the time, and obviously he was older then. And he said, what was it like giving birth? He literally just asked me the question. And I said, oh yeah, it was pretty easy. And I just went, it was the first time I'd ever gone with the flow of just going, yeah, whatever, I'm just going to pretend that I gave birth to him.
I love it. Yeah. And it's so true, isn't it? You have to pick and choose your, not battles, but often some of the stuff that we share with people, they're not expecting it. And it can be a little bit eye-opening and not what they're expecting to hear. And it's a bit of a choice on our part, you know, like as to whether or not we share or feel like we might be oversharing with certain individuals. And so, yeah, sometimes you just need to do that, don't you? Just rather than get involved in the whole conversation, you know.
You kept asking me questions. I'm thinking, I'm digging myself a deeper hole here. I really, but I think I don't want him to have the kind of, I guess, I don't like the phrase, like a label over his head. I want him to feel like any child. I don't want him to think that adoption is different, that it is very much lots of, you know, he has children that he knows that are adopted, children in his school that are adopted. And, you know, he does talk about it more freely because social services do encourage you to do that from a young age, so that it is normal. It's not seen as strange, odd. Yes, he will have questions as he gets older. You know, yes, there'll be times, and we've been warned that there are times throughout their life that they will go through the ups and downs of kind of their identity, where they come from, you know, talking about things with school. People talk about family tree and all these things that come up. And yes, there will be times where he's maybe feeling a bit unsettled or unsure, but he certainly sees it as a very open thing. He talks about it fairly freely. He says that he's adopted. He says that he has a friend who has a papa and a dada in his school, which is beautiful to hear. So it's lovely to know that he kind of has that identity, that he does recognise that. I don't think he fully understands what's behind it. But yes, it's definitely good. Rather than having that shock factor, you know, when I'm 18, I find out that I'm adopted, or, you know, much, much further down the line. It needs to be something that's talked about quite openly from a young age.
And he's primary school age now, isn't he?
He is, yes.
Yeah. Oh, and so, like, I am really curious, I guess, like going back to the baby groups, just in case there's someone listening to this who is about to or has been through similar with adopting a baby. Like, did you talk about it in the baby groups? Were people receptive when you told them that he was adopted?
Yeah, I mean, like you say, I did pick and choose really who I spoke to about it. And I think it was more that I felt comfortable talking. There were some mums that I knew and I got to know, and I felt more comfortable telling them the story, whereas some others I wouldn't really go into too much detail. And I think because you kind of go around the circuit at that point when you have a baby, you start to see the same familiar faces when you go into town, when you go, I mean, obviously not at the moment, but, you know, you used to go for coffee, you used to go, you know, and you'd always bump into, it was kind of like a sort of similar circle. I think I would have liked to have had a bit more support in the sense of connecting with adoptive parents, because I was quite surprised that they didn't really have anything, like social services didn't really have anything that was local to my area. Because it just makes you feel I guess, a little bit more part of something rather than maybe different to something, or you didn't want to necessarily have to talk your story, or, you know, I didn't want to have to share every time I met a new person, I didn't want to have to share that story. But yes, I mean, I got there eventually, and you start to get in the flow of what you do as a mum. You know, you go to certain playgroups on certain days of the week. It helps with getting you out of the house. It helps your sanity levels. You start to meet people. You start to get more support, and you start to kind of settle down.
And I can say from, you know, like the pictures that I see on your Facebook, like the three of you have a wonderful and happy life together. You really yes. do. That little Thank boy you. Is a very, very lucky boy to have found you guys. He really
Thank
is.
Thank you very much.
And I'm sorry that it took so long to get there and you went through so much to get there, particularly, I guess, with the actual adoption process. And I one thing I was going to mention then is just like, I think it's really brave of you that you actually complained, essentially, because I can imagine that must have been a really difficult thing to do, going almost against the people who you want to befriend, because they're the ones who have your fate in their hands in many ways. So that's incredibly brave. And you have continued to be brave because you want to, you know, share the story about adoption, obviously keeping your son's identity and things private, which is, as we were talking about before we started recording, to a degree that's a social services requirement, but also personally that's something you would prefer to do. But you have written a book about adoption inspired by your son, so yes. tell us a bit about that.
So yes, the book Eddie Finds a Family. So I started writing it in May of last year as part of kind of coping with lockdown. I think I just found a group, got into it, and then decided that I was going to write a children's book. And it kind of went from there. I think when we adopted our son, we didn't really feel there was any books out there that explained adoption. We kind of searched, you know, we were given a few here and there, but they were kind of quite bland, or they weren't colourful. They weren't capturing, you know, children love colourful books with lots of, you know, fun characters, something that they can engage with. And it was very much, you know, I wanted to create a book that was had a powerful story, but it was vibrant, it was honest, it was open, it was colourful. And so, yes, Flossie and Frank, the flamingos, adopt a little chick called Eddie the emu. And again, it's showing that diversity. It's showing the difference. You don't necessarily have to look the same. There's lots of different characters within the book. I didn't want to kind of, you know, just go with the flow that Flossie and Frank adopt a flamingo. I wanted it to look different so that it helped children to understand adoption better. And also it does go through the sensitivity of adoption. So it goes through the parents' journey to adopt, which I don't think a lot of books cover, which is important because our son asks us questions. Where did you find me? Was I lost? He says these kinds of questions to us, and he's interested to know our side of the story, which I don't think a lot of books do. And then obviously it's important to have the child's perspective. So Eddie, you see him in foster care in the book, and then you see how he's very excited to find a new mummy and daddy, and, you know, and yes, obviously they have a happy ending at the end. So yes, indeed. So it's been a wonderful experience. I've really enjoyed it. And I want to continue with Eddie. I want to kind of expand his series of books. So the next one I'm currently writing is about him settling in with his new mummy and daddy. So because, again, that's something that's not really talked about within books. You kind of go through the adoption stage and then they, you know, live happily ever after. And actually, it's not always happily ever after. There are things that go, that the bumps, as Nick said in his book, the bumps ahead. It's very much the ups and downs of being a parent. And with adoption, there is a lot to learn. So I want to kind of introduce Eddie, and, you know, Eddie goes to school and all these things that will hopefully happen within his journey.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you so much, Sarah. That's amazing. Like, it's an incredible book, and people can find more about the book and about you at The Flamingo Family, can't they?
.co.uk. So a website. The hardback books are sold out at the moment, so there isn't actually any showing there, but it is on Amazon. The softback version is on Amazon at the moment, and I'm encouraging people to join my Facebook group because I want people to kind of engage in my next book. So there is a Facebook group called The Flamingo Family, and with a picture of Eddie dancing, and so you'll be able to see it. But yeah, I'm just trying to get some engagement. It's lovely for parents, you know, not just adoptive parents, but parents to be involved in the storyline, in thinking about things that I should maybe include in the next book, the book title, you know, starting that discussion. It's important. I'd love to have people involved. So
brilliant, brilliant. Yeah, because I can imagine just like what I want to do, and what I'm starting to do even more so with the podcast is, like, I had a hashtag that we still use with Kat and Alice now as well, every story matters. Like, I want to share stories to whether it is about being finally pregnant or, you know, finally parenting, like you weren't pregnant as such, but you're finally parenting now. And yes. because I want people to listen to it because it might not be their journey, but as I always say, we don't know what might be around the corner for us, but also it helps us to advocate on behalf of each other, you know, and that's what I really want to do, and to understand as well. And I asked this in my interview with Sheikah recently, who had a premature baby, and this might be perhaps just dropping an idea here for a book. But, you know, like as an outsider, you know, how do we support you, and or how does one support an adoptive family in the best way? And whether that's about supporting the child, whether that's about supporting the parents, whether that is about asking, you know, like, what was the adoption like and can we do it? Like, we're in a very safe setting here and that is what we are here to do. But if I met someone at a baby group, you know, what are the questions that I should be asking or shouldn't be asking, or that kind of stuff. There is a lot to be discussed.
Yeah, because you do get some questions which can be quite awkward, because they will go in saying, so what's the history of his, you know, his parents? And you're like, it's kind of quite private. You know, I don't want to be displaying all of his, you know, that's his story, and it should be kept that way. But yeah, some people are a bit too forthcoming with their questions, and others avoid the topic. So I guess it's about the happy medium. But yeah, definitely a good idea for another book.
Wonderful.
I'll write it down.
You can dedicate it to me. That's fine. Kat, this is what you should do. Oh, brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Sarah. I really,
thank
really
you. No,
you
thank you so
us.
Much for inviting me. It's been lovely to chat to you after such a long time.
I know, exactly. But yeah, huge congratulations on your family, and huge thank congratulations you. On your book. And we look forward to many, many more joining it. All
thank
right, then.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Take care.
Bye. Bye.